Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Oh, hi, friends.
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi.
Ryan Brushwood.
Ahoy!
A couple things to talk about. One of them was, I read an article that was talking about the kind of the place that online media is in right now. You know, the last several years, we watched, you know, the rise of Vice, BuzzFeed, Vox as sort of this, I think kind of in the Facebook article sharing world that they said, hey, let's, it's kind of was like a revival of like, you know, the rise of the blogs from over 10 years ago. But now we had this consolidation where people build these platforms and then, you know, you'd advertise them, you know, monetize them, et cetera. And they became kind of big entities. But now they're finding out that like, you know, ad rates are still going down and producing content's hard. And some of these appear to be struggling. And I wanted to figure out, let's put it to the team. What is the future of media?
Oh boy.
Brian.
I think it was it last week on this show that we talked about the idea of
cheap jobs,
of getting back to paying for media and whether it be in Warcraft Gold or some other fictional thing. Are we still on board with the possibility of that, or do we think?
Well,
that...
here's the problem, Brian.
Hello, big media. It's me, Brian. I had an idea. It involves creators getting paid directly with a virtual currency that maybe has tangible value and doesn't require a credit card number so people would feel good about spending it freely, sir.
Silence!
Oh, I'm
big
sorry.
Media is about to speak.
I'm sorry. Yes,
Brian.
Yes, big media.
The problem with your idea, Brian, the Jeep Jop proposal.
Yes, Jeep Jops. That's what I call them, sir. Just last week, I was telling it to my friends Justin and Andrew and Bryce, and they all seemed to feel like I had a real potential, big media.
People won't pay for something when it's freely available out there.
Sir, if I may, is that entirely true? It seems like all of Patreon is filled with people who are paying for something that they're getting for free otherwise.
What's the total size? So the question is what's the market size and what is the total number of podcasts, the total number of podcasts that monetize on Patreon. And we're talking about the blogosphere, the newsosphere, whatever. Is that where we're going to go? Cause part of it is, you know, the idea that, you know, are we going to go switch over to, are we going to switch over to a model where like blog posts, news posts, things like this, you know, Patreon's a great model because with particularly podcasts and stuff where you have a much better relationship with your awesome, beautiful, sexy audience.
Ooh, oh my God. I was talking about our audience the other day and I was like, damn, they're looking fit. They're looking good.
Yeah. You guys look, I want to kiss you.
Well, I guess the challenge comes into is that your I think the biggest disruptor is going to be as we shift more to automatic content creation, is that you're going to get, you know, that those quick hits, those pieces and whatever auto-generated stuff. And if you're BuzzFeed and you can say, well, we could try to, you know, like BuzzFeed like has like they're trying to sell like products and stuff like cookingware and things like this. Like you look at the directions they're going into. Vox makes TV shows. They're becoming kind of a traditional media company in that right. But it's not clear that that's really the way to go. And I think like a paid model for part of it. But if there's somebody out there able to, if you're somebody who says, hey, you know, I can make money. I can, you know, Jeff Bezos famously says that like your time, your slim margin is, you know, my opportunity, you know? And so when somebody says, well, we're going to make BuzzFeed, like paid model, like a subscription model for BuzzFeed ain't going to help BuzzFeed.
It's so weird that if you go back and you watch me launching the scam stuff channel, and it's going to be tempting for me to want to portray myself as a visionary or whatever. I'm no visionary. I am somebody who's back against was.
Wait, Brian, is that a vision?
Silence! The visionary will speak now.
In 2012, I was no visionary. I was somebody who found out that his wife was pregnant with their third child and realized
his child shall be born, he said.
I was somebody who realized that I couldn't afford to pay for everything by going out on tour. And of course, in the music sector, that was the big mantra, was like, oh, well, you'll make it up by going on tour. You'll get famous. All your stuff will be free and pirated, but you'll be on tour. And then meanwhile, there's some people who can't go on tour. And they have to figure out a way to make cash. So and there were moves I couldn't make because this is before I think in 2012, you know, I'm working for Discovery Digital Online, doing Scam School, which you know, it's not like I could go sell ads on this thing that is a property that I'm doing for another company. Same thing, Modern Rogue did not exist. I was working on I knew a TV show was in the works, but again, that wasn't going to be owned by me. That's me working for National Geographic. There weren't many moves, and so Scam Stuff was born out of desperation, and so it was just like, I don't know what else to do. I know that I wrote a Scam School book, and it seems to have sold. That was great. I wrote a sequel to it. That seems to have sold. And we've told this story before, but it was halfway through what was going to be a crunch weekend where we were desperately going to put out a third Scam School book and release it digitally, like in a matter of days, just so I could stop sinking farther and farther into debt. And then as we realized, like, oh my gosh, this is just never going to end, we had the idea of like, okay, what if whatever that engine is that caused people to want to buy our books, what if that could be applied to something that wasn't so creatively draining over and over and over again? So in 2012, we did an Indiegogo to create Scam Stuff. And of course, you know, the story is it continues to be the most transformative thing that we've done. And it was able to finance all these changes and foundings of new properties like the Modern Rogue, that now we are in a position to sell advertisements on and to do brand deals with. And it's very curious to me that juggernauts like BuzzFeed are essentially making the same move that I made 5 years ago, that I find that deeply validating on a totally selfish personal level, and has me very, very excited that maybe I happened to luck into a smart decision 5 years ago.
Perhaps. Now, I will point out that when Yahoo was struggling in the late 90s or early 2000s for profitability, Yahoo started a product line. Yahoo branded DVD players and Yahoo branded merchandise. And that's considered sometimes a death rattle.
Correct. And that is, if I can run that through the filter of how we grew Scam Stuff, we figured out very quickly that we could never compete on commodity products. That everything we had to do had to be, quote unquote, an original. And I'm using air quotes because that doesn't mean that that we had to build everything from scratch and have a totally unique original idea. You'll notice that a lot of the stuff on Scam Stuff are, we make sure that they're particular bundles, and that's specifically for, okay, what is the experience that we're selling? And we've talked about the Houdini sell is a good example of it. You could deconstruct all of the pieces and, much like a iPhone teardown, calculate, okay, this is the actual dollar amount that it costs to get all these pieces done individually, and that this is an estimated projection of the profits they're making. But if we do our job right, you realize that buying all those pieces individually gets you no closer to the story that we're trying to sell with that. So everything on the store, and we're getting better and better at it over time, we're realizing that we're selling experiences and stories in a way that I don't think a Yahoo branded DVD player or although a BuzzFeed cookbook is a good example of that. You were saying you were interested in it, Bryce?
Oh yeah, Tasty, which is BuzzFeed's cooking brand, has like, they have a couple of cookbooks now, which is like some of the stuff that they do videos on, but then now they're also doing like hey, we sell cookware sets. Hey, we sell the little glass bowl things that you see us use. Hey, cookie sets.
And forgive me for putting it in mockable terms a la Night Attack, but what they're really selling is the experience of doing the stuff from the cookbook and not having to go out and get the right gizmos for everything.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they even sell I don't even know if they still sell it, but they at one point sold like induction cookers that they used in their videos. So it's like the entire process that they do essentially
I think that funnel is so much of what blog money making has become is Amazon affiliate. And they know what they're getting paid on. They know what their readers are buying. And so they can say, all right, what if some of these we just made ourselves? Like, what if we became the Amazon and said, okay, well, we'll sell you these things that we know you're already coming to and using us as a portal to go buy, as long as we can kind of compete on, you know, price or create the reason why you need, this is the hottest deal,
right?
Then that makes sense. Where I think scam stuff is different is you are creating a more traditional mail order experience that is kind of devoid from the art. You know, like you literally just took your audience and said, hey, are you also interested in being a mail order customer for my curation of products? And they were, excited. And you tell the story, but it's all kind of within that scam stuff universe. It's not like Scam School or Modern Rogue had an 8-part series on Houdini leading up to the release of the Houdini's cell. It was all there on the website page. It was in the copy of the email. And that's very traditionally, like, that's, if this were the 50s, 60s, 70s or 80s, it would be a little magazine that would go out to everybody.
I mean, you're 100% right in that. I mean, really, I guess I'm playing the same game as the Sharper Image played, or the J. Peterman catalog from Seinfeld fame.
Yeah.
You know, or even more recently, you know, Robert Redford's Sundance brands, where, you know, now you got Sundance like salads for women or whatever. Like you know, it's you have a halo in an ecosystem, and as long as there's the belief, hopefully an earned belief, that the person who you trust is personally curating all this, then it feels like it can work. Which I think it's interesting on the BuzzFeed example, because clearly they've built up, what's the food series that it's branded under?
Tasty.
So they've built up enough credit with Tasty that you believe, okay, if they're going to do the same filters that they do for the quality content of Tasty, then you're interested in whatever cookbook and cookware they recommend.
Yeah. And you know, their stuff is commoditized too, right? Like, you know, those little glass bowls, I bought a bunch of those on Amazon last week for probably way cheaper.
Right.
Yeah.
But a lot of their stuff is like, it's colorful and it's very visual. And so it plays into kind of what is attractive about Tasty's videos, which is that it looks very good.
You just hit on it. Right. They're selling that stuff because you partially like them, because they take pretty photos and they take pretty videos, and you want your photos and videos in an increasingly shareable world to be as pretty as the Tasty videos. So when you cook your thing and you're like, oh, look what I made, and in the background it's a pot, a pan, and a few bowls that you use to mix your carbonara pasta, you want them to look cool and good and fun and fresh, and not like, you know, some plastic tub that you used margarine out of that now you're using as a measuring cup.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, trends I've been observing, one is like, there's a blog, one of the blogs I go to, like half of the content's like, hey, check out, like, you think it's a review of something cool and you realize, no, it's an Amazon, you know, affiliate link. And they're, you know, there was the idealistic sort of version of what journalism and the web was going to be that we'd hear 15, 20 years ago, of like, oh, we'll do this and we'll have the wall. And like, when people, layoffs happen, the wall gets thinner, then the wall goes away. And you take a brand like Vice, you know, which is, you know, this irreverent brand, which is, you know, truth to power. And you go to look at their page and like, hey, look at this video. Oh, it's created with Geico. What does that mean? Is this a sponsor? Is this advertisement? I don't know when you say it's created with a corporate partner and you've, you know, it used to be sponsored posts, sponsored this, but they found out, you know what, people don't read them as much. So we'll make that. I watched like CNN do that and other ones like they will. We'll make the font smaller and smaller and smaller, which is like, why are you doing this? Because you're hoping people won't notice it and will click on it, which is disingenuous.
So I think if we're looking at it, then we can agree that basing a media model on advertising is probably not future proof, right? That we have already seen enough of an erosion there that you would want to build, if let's say theoretically somebody were trying to make a larger media empire, you would probably not just say, all right, well, views, subs, and then the advertising, and then we wait by the dock of the bay for the advertising ship to roll in and pour the money out.
Yes.
I don't know. I think that if you, the problem is this, as I see it, is let's say we launched, let's do scam weird jury media, right? And you know, in conglomeration with Castillo, we decide to form this thing. We're like, you know what? We're going to produce X amount of podcasts.
Hold on. I like scam weird jury media, a Neshcom company.
Yes.
A Neshcom company.
We form this thing and we say, oh yeah, we're going to do X number of blog posts. This, we know that like, hey, this is what impressions are going for right now and blog stuff. Well, the thing that often happens is you go like, and that will keep falling. You know, that rate at which what you're going to get paid for impressions is going to keep falling. That's the problem a lot of these media companies have is this year you're making, you know, a penny per 100,000 or whatever. I mean, remember when like you could measure them like and by what 1,000 impressions would get you. And now because of social media and, you know, the content machines of Facebook and all these other things, it's fractional. But if we said this right now, we'd be screwed because in 3 years time you could say like, yeah, but the payment per impression is going to go so low that won't work. But if we said, okay, we're going to build an AI or something that's going to increase exponentially the amount of content it creates, which is sort of like how Facebook works or whatever, then I'd say, yeah, then you could still do an ad model. You could say, yes, we've looked at the curve, the rate at which these things, you know, the impressions, you know, what you get paid per impression decline. We think we can improve our targeting rate, but also we're not going to have 50 writers writing this stuff. We're going to have 50 writers, and this year they're going to be able to write 100,000 articles. Next year they'll figure out if you know a way to do a million and whatever. That might work. But yeah, a traditional media thing, no, you're screwed, in my opinion. Because like, I just watched that erosion of that wall and these blogs and places that would have been the first ones to cry foul several years ago about like, oh, well, you know, this isn't really clearly marked as advertising. Look what they're doing. It's unethical. Look at this site here. They're not telling you this is thing. It's like, now they're doing it because they like food and eating and having jobs. So solved.
Yeah. I mean, here's what I would say. I do think that what seems to be the trend, both macro and micro, is that media is a great way to get people into the door for something else. Mm-hmm. And it's the reason why you're finding a lot of the something else's that are buying up media companies now that they're kind of cheap, because advertising totally sort of like fell off a cliff from where it was and its importance. So I think that, you know, Brian's idea of like, hey, look, here's a mail order universe, and we can take those lessons and we can learn, like, now if we do want to do more direct merch, if let's say Modern Rogue wanted to start selling Jason Murphy's pants that are like a running joke on the show, you would know
world's not ready for this,
why to do
it,
where to source it, you know, that kind of stuff. Like for whatever that widget would be, you would know more how to be able to get people into a reliable funnel of effectively mail marketing and target for them exactly what they want, be it something that is either a story you're telling them just from your initial approach or a payoff from a larger artistic venture. And I think it's easier when you're someone like Brian or a podcasting like thing where you can kind of take your show where you want it, even if you're covering, you know, I think The Ringer's been a good example of like, they're covering sports, but they've kind of created a little mini fashion line for themselves of just well-designed t-shirts that smart sports fans want to wear so they can signify themselves as smart sports fans. That's kind of a smart idea that you're allowed to do.
My hesitation comes from this is that, and I think, yes, you need to, like, TechCrunch, you know, years ago started doing the TechCrunch conferences, which was a smart thing.
Yes.
You go to TechCrunch because I want to know what's coming. I want to know what's there. TechCrunch could do a great job of getting the best guests for that. And we're seeing more of that, like Recode and other ones will do these conferences as a way to basically, and also it's sort of a, there are ways, multiple ways to make money from a conference. One is just pure admission. Also, if you're a company or whatever, and you want to show off and you want to present. And that's the thing, too. You have to look at these TechCrunch conferences and some of these startup. Like, we're doing a startup conference. They're not there to help you get funding. They're there to make money with the dream that you bring your startup there or whatever. You know, it's the illusion of access. It's the illusion of this. It's not necessarily – their incentive isn't quite necessarily what we may think it is. Not that it makes it wrong, but you have to keep that in mind. What's interesting to me is looking at like BuzzFeed, like they had last month reported BuzzFeed makes $50 million in e-commerce revenues, which means they had $50 million in sales, which sounds good, but like they have a 65 person team working on this. And if you factor in like what their actual profit is or whatever, it's the problem is it's like now you're a consumer brand trying to figure out how to create products that's already an extremely competitive space. And it's really hard to do that. You know, it's hard enough to launch a product and create something, you know, how do you make it work? You know, how do you succeed at this? So, I don't know. It's not the answer, but I know it's a hard answer. It's a hard one. Cause you're still now facing the problem of.
Yeah, I don't know what other moves there are. That article that just got flashed up talked to, you know, sort of was asking the question, what's the point of having a BuzzFeed membership? That would be direct paying for the content.
Yeah, like
then
PR.
You can rent out your bandwidth, your space, your good name to someone else to, you know, get a Dollar Shave Club or whatever. You can sell your own stuff. It's not clear to me how else you fund all of these things, especially in a world where the moment you come up with something original and new idea, it's going to be 20 minutes until somebody is copying it or possibly doing it faster, better, stronger, whatever.
You know, and I think that gets to the heart of you have to figure out what the real value is of what you do and not what you want the value to be is like, I write wonderful tech blog posts. Like, yeah, but it's a commodity. And, you know, what you've done, Brian, and what Justin, what you've done is you've got a relationship with an audience, and those relationships are extremely powerful. That brand loyalty is significant, and that's, you know, what you're both looking to expand and do that. I think that one of the problems of some of these brands is they can be so interchangeable, you know, because writers go here and there. There is no strong voice. Vice has sort of a voice, but Vice has sort of become a lot of different things, and it's not a rare voice online. It was just.
I mean, look, if you have a camera drone and high test marijuana, you too can have the unique voice of Vice Media and videos.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I think part of it comes down to sort of answering, like asking that question, like what do I have as a value? And like, you know, Brian, it's your personality, your relationship with people, you know, Justin, ditto. And I use Justin as an example often. I'll point out like his politics YouTube channel doesn't have a ginormous amount of people viewing it, but the people who view it are highly dedicated to Justin and worth way more than a casual random YouTube viewer.
Well, and likewise, the fact that Justin, if yes, of course, his personality and his charisma, but more importantly, I believe, is his unique nonpartisan take, his ability to be, you notice that, you know, when you're watching ESPN, they're not loudly proclaiming, like, oh, these anti-Cowboys, other teams, what a piece of work they are. You know, the fact that you're able to bring insight to me, it's the insights, about the game in general, not about the perspective from one team or the other.
I agree. What else?
So Bryce pulled up a very interesting site that I'd not heard of before, and now I'm looking at it, which is very interesting. Graphtreon, which is data on Patreon, and taking a look at like what Patreon, like, you know, Patreon, we think is a wonderful example for facilitating you connecting with your audience and making that happen. By the way, patreon.com/weirdthings. And if you click on the statistics of what they've accumulated, and I don't know, like, this seems to be fairly recent, like, what's fascinating to me is you look at like the total number of individual pledges, like 5 million, the estimated number of payouts, 12.3 million, number of creators, 126,000. So it's a tiny, tiny market. And if you click on the number one market is, I believe, video. And I think second is podcasts. Let me take a look through here.
So yeah, video is at 3.8 million per month and podcast is at 1.4 million per month.
Quick proviso. All of these are just the reported public numbers. Like, for example, our numbers are public, but somebody like Philip DeFranco does not make his numbers public.
Interesting. So I wonder, do we have any estimate of like what percentage are public and what not aren't?
I believe the majority of them are public. It seems like only people at the top who are afraid that making their numbers public will reduce people's enthusiasm for contributing.
But it does look like that could be hundreds of thousands of dollars hidden from these stats.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Or easily millions, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd be curious. But we'd be curious to figure that out. And that's one of the things, too, is that we don't have a whole lot of data on a lot of this stuff. Like, we don't know, you know, there's so much about this, the business and the scope of business that we don't know. And sometimes even companies don't know. Once a company gets large enough, it's more divisions, people wanting to protect their jobs and groups within companies competing against each other. And you take like, you know, we saw that like the BuzzFeed, like, you know, we had, you know, 50 million in revenue. It's like, well, you got 63 employees and that revenue doesn't say profit. So like, is this, are you earning? Are you, when you're having your heart to heart meeting with your bosses and stuff, are you saying, well, we increased it this year over year, so we think in 3 years time, this will be the major revenue source. So right now we're costing you money, but we don't think we will all time. And here, but I was just curious, like looking at like the podcasting thing, like this is tiny. This is really, really tiny. You know, you look at the statistics on podcasts. So we see here, there are 678,000 individual pledges. And a lot of those are people doing multiples. Like, you know, I probably pay for like three or four.
Yeah.
So we're probably looking at maybe 200,000 to 300,000 people paying for podcasts. The total estimated public payouts is 1.4 million, 1.5 million, which is, you know, again, that's monthly. So
spread out over nearly 10,000 creators. All of a sudden, that doesn't seem like a gigantic thing. It was like maybe 1,500 per month per podcast on the average in total.
Yeah, let's see. Let's do that. The math on that. So,
but
it's like $166 per podcast.
Hmm. Yeah. Wait, is it
1.5 million divided by like 8,800?
Yep.
Yeah, it's $166 per
now,
podcast.
This 8,000 doesn't include podcasts that have no patrons. So there could possibly be zero patron campaigns.
And plus also that 1.5 million is, again, only reported numbers. But I perceive that more people are comfortable reporting their numbers on podcasts over video.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, it's still, you know, it's, you know, on one hand, I look at these numbers like, oh, but I'm like, well, those are monthly. Like, you know, it's like, you know, Patreon's bringing in like $144 million, you know, a year towards creators, which is wonderful. I mean, it's just wonderful that exists. And we're early stages. So I guess what I'm saying is like, yeah, this is just the starting point there. So solutions like this are sort of neat. But yeah, anyhow, worth looking at this. Worth looking at the other side of this. Like, you know, streaming, one of these things, you know, that's other stuff too. It's like, you know, sometimes we go, why don't they do this? And you have to look at the economics of it. You have to look at the model of that and go like, well, this won't scale beyond this point. It won't sustain something else. So, but are we going to see like, you know, to the Jeep Jop or something like that? Are we going to see a player like Amazon come in and say, hey, you know, we know Amazon is already making a lot of money in advertising and they want to get bigger and bigger and bigger and not just within the Amazon ecosystem.
Man, you know what I could totally see? And it's a little bit dark to even imagine. I can see Amazon in as soon as a year or two say, hey, we have an exciting new opportunity. Our new AI bots listen to every one of your podcasts and contextualize the things you're talking about. You're not even selling a thing. You're talking about the Super Bowl game. You're talking about this. You're talking about your favorite commercials. You're talking about your favorite science fiction books or whatever. Our bots will listen to all of your podcasts. If you just click this checkbox, we will run all ads based on who's pixeled as being confirmed as somebody who listens to your podcast, and they will see relevant ads because we now have an idea of what's on their mind, and that'll help us sell stuff. And again, it'll all be relevant. And you'll just get checks in the mail, and you don't have to think about, you're not selling anything. You're just being you, you crazy diamond. And all you need to do is allow us to follow and know what your podcast says and allow people who we think to be your fans to receive ads placed from us that are relevant to their interests due to neural network, AI, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been playing with the Amazon transcription service, you know, and actually I've been testing it on our podcast, by the way, just because like having multiple audio sources to see. Accuracy is still not super, super high. It can identify separate speakers, but if you're looking for keywords and keyword insertion and stuff, I mean, our keyword placement, totally, totally viable. We've flirted with that for years. Like we had a project years ago to do, you know, automatic ad insertion, which other people are doing now, which, you know, other people who are smarter and, you know, follow through on things. It could be because like, yeah, there's the thing we see, you know, Google did AdWords and AdWords were a super cheap, easy way to put ads everywhere because you could do hundreds of thousands of impressions and it didn't cost you anything as far as human labor. And then we said, oh, that's the way things work. And then, you know, with Facebook and the Facebook stream of data, you know, you could do a model like that. You watch Snapchat struggle because they don't have quite their version of it.
Let me pitch this then. Let's look at the Jeep job. Let's look at who could step in and make a micro payment system that you would trust, that would be able to say, all right, look, we want to save news. We want to safeguard news. It is something that we even find an altruistic point of view for. And we want you to be able to pay in a seamless way that you don't even have to think about it. You just know that you care about this kind of stuff and you want to reward the people that make it. And so maybe it's a recurring fee that you know, put up, but there's some clever frictionless way that you just kick this entity a little bit of money and then it gets spread in a very smart and interesting way that raises the bottom line of all boats. I would wonder whether or not that company is, I think firstly, you would need somebody that has a lot of credit cards already. So it creates getting into that tent a little easier. And also somebody with maybe a bone to pick with an anti-advertisement harvesting kind of agenda. Like, I don't know if Apple would not fit both of those categories.
I'm sure the will is there, but if you... You know, Apple and social media and stuff like look at, you know, Apple came out with, you know, Apple News, right? Yes. Do you use the News app on your phone at all?
I have actually used it more on my watch. My current watch interface has the News right front and center. And I found myself swiping through the top five stories. I will say it has not distinguished itself as particularly useful to me.
I'm like really into Feedly, so I use Feedly a lot. I haven't bothered to really dig down into News to try to do this. I know from some advertisers where, you know, some media outlets, they weren't super thrilled with it because they're not seeing the same sort of ad rates,
right?
You know, and Apple's goal of like, hey, and like you click over on Wired, you know, like they'll sell you a subscription to Wired on here. But like, I mean, I haven't been really thrilled with Wired's coverage and a long time. So, you know, I used to be a big subscriber to the magazine that I watched to get thinner and thinner and thinner. And then ads become, you know, I'm like, oh, if I need to buy a watch or a car, pick up a copy of Wired magazine, you know, and then get a half-assed piece on something that I felt like was, they should have paid the writer to do more, you know?
I agree with all of your criticisms, which is why, and I don't think that this is likely, but just to muse on it, I think the idea of Apple being more than of a, hey, look, kick us X amount of dollars a month, and we'll make the deals with the New York Times and the Washington Post and Wired and Wall Street Journal. These are meetings that we can take, that we can probably knock that out. And it'll be seamless. If it's on your phone, if it's on your browser and you're logged in to iCloud, then we already know what, you know, if you agree that we can give these people your money now, congratulations. All these sites are now unlocked for you, and we distribute the cash based on the stuff that you read.
And I could see Apple making like a big lifestyle bundle, right? Like, hey, give us $30 a month and you will get Apple Music and you'll get access to whatever the Apple Video thing is going to be. You get Apple News, which will have New York Times or Washington Post, like unlimited access to, you know, to news outlets. Like, I could see them making a very like home focused, all encompassing plan.
I could see that, and I certainly think that Amazon Prime is even further along the lines of doing that.
100%,
right.
But the problem is this, is that, and this is one of the problems with like streaming music and things like this. There's things that sound great to the consumer. If I pay $10, I get all this. But then there are things that are really bad for the content producers. Right. And if you're New York Times and you're like, okay, Apple says they'll pay us 60 cents a month, you know, or 30 cents a month to have, you know, New York Times for every Apple subscriber. One, it sounds kind of cool, but then you're like, yeah, but if everybody that wants to get a New York Times subscription decides to do that instead, we're not going to get by, you know, these deals are often made in the short run because to see how well they work out. In the long run, it doesn't scale because it's like, no, we want that, whatever, near $5 a month, $10 a month, whatever that price is. And we can undersell it for a while, but it's not a sustainable business model in the long run because, you know, there are not enough people paying.
Dude, 150%, because I do think that Prime is further along in doing something like that. And yet there's a reason why, as a Prime subscriber, you only get a discount on a Washington Post subscription, despite the fact that Bezos owns both, yeah, although separately. Yeah, I think that if there was a deal to be made there of putting Washington Post as part of your Prime membership, they would have made that deal before. But I am sure that there are, you know, the accounting department of the Post is like, well, I don't think that this is going to work out for us, guys. Like, we're not going to be able to, even if we open the floodgates and we get, you know, whatever that fractional cent is from an Amazon Prime subscription that has to already be split a million different ways and feed a million different mouths, I don't think that we're really going to be able to do it. And it also might create some antitrust issues and some lobbying problems for Bezos. But
I'm trying to think of, and not necessarily streaming media, but streaming media definitely is the big one. How many of these like subscription-based consumption models are profitable? And of those, or out of everything, all separate question, how many of those are maybe exploitative to creators, right? Like, you look at, like, is Netflix profitable yet, or aren't they still like keep getting into debt? Look at Spotify, which doesn't really pay artists a lot because the use is so high.
Netflix is, I think Netflix is still, it's growth phase. And the beautiful thing about Netflix too is that, like, and the difference between them and Spotify is that Netflix is shifting more towards in-house things they own.
Sure.
And there's going to be a point at which they can say, hey, we've got globally, you know, a billion Netflix subscribers, you know, paying us, you know, $50 billion. We're making, you know, we're a billion subscribers at, you know, 10 billion, you know, 100. If we're making $40 billion a year, whatever, we can spend 20% of this on content and everybody's happy and our model is there. And then that's why with Netflix, the model right now is, it's one of the reasons why they're shifting away from Marvel is they want to own the IP outright because they make a lot of money from Stranger Things merchandise in this. And they bought the rights to Marvel stuff because initially, why get Netflix streaming? Oh, you get all this cool Marvel. They wanted to use the Marvel name. Now they're like, why are we paying? We have this platform that is huge. There's, you know, 100 million Netflix subscribers in the United States. It's a great platform. Now we can use this platform. Their next area of growth, their content is solved for them. I would say that they could exist forever at the model they're at right now. They could dial back some of what they pay for licensing fees and still have enough content to keep people happy. But their next area of growth is going to be owning IP that has value outside of streaming. Like, I talked this on Twitter, like a Netflix theme park is not a crazy idea when you think about, you know, IP and stuff.
Sure. But
sorry, real quick. By the way, in 2017, Netflix's reported net profit was $558.9 million. So it's making money.
It's making money. Yeah. But also they're, you know, reinvesting all of that into more, you know, doubling down on content, like Andrew said. Like HBO, maybe, like
Again, talk about the thing that needs to exist just because it's a entryway into another thing. You know, AT&T bought Time Warner, and a lot of that was HBO because they can use that glittering lore of hey, get on UVerse and you'll get Game of Thrones for free, right? Like, or you'll get a bundle with, because now we own HBO,
right?
Those places are in good models. They're in good hands, you know, when they own the content outright. Or Spotify, the problem they have is they have to pay all these licensing fees, and that can keep creeping up unless they start to produce and become record album themselves. But even then, it's challenging, where Netflix is in a much better position. Now, just going to throw this out, BuzzFeed podcasts.
I feel like I have actually looked through the handful of podcasts that they do.
Well, very recently. I hope you enjoyed what you saw, because they let go of their in-house podcasting team a couple months ago.
Oh, really?
And if you go to BuzzFeed Podcast to see the list of podcasts there,
there were none that I recognized in
and
any of this
you
stuff.
Have like one from you scroll down there, like there's a Lena Dunham podcast, right. Woman of the Hour season one. And the last episode of that was 3 years ago. I don't know if we're going to get season two.
But apparently, yeah, I would doubt it. Yeah, you know, funny story there. I was at a wedding a couple weeks ago with a friend of mine from college who is now the producer for Slow Burn, the series on Slate that was very acclaimed and was named one of the top podcasts for this year. All about the first season was about the Watergate. Second season was about the Clinton impeachment. And we were just going through the business of a big podcast and everything, because I was just picking his brain. And I was like, yeah, what, didn't Slate lay off a bunch of podcast people? And they're like, yeah, they laid off some of their other podcast people, but they love us and we want to be there forever and yada, yada, yada. And I'm like, you know, they need you for what you're doing more than you need them. Like, I think at this point, your podcast install base is what it is. They probably helped a lot to launch, because they're going to help you stand out, because Slate's a good brand for podcast listeners. But at this point, I don't really know how much, you know, if they're not giving you a bigger budget or you know, more something that you can't get by yourself, like, I don't know how much it matters. And then I emailed him for something else last week, and he's like, hey, funny you should mention what you pitched to me. I got back to work and my boss pitched me the same idea, because he'd been talking to venture funders. And so I don't know if you noticed, but Slow Burn left Slate, and the new season of whatever the new podcast is going to be called will not be involved in Slate. And I don't know if they got the name or the feeds, but hopefully they did. But it's like, look, that's not there anymore. Like the idea of the podcast network as part of another thing for that, like for a predominantly display advertising and cookware reseller, there's not a lot of money there for BuzzFeed. There wasn't a lot of money there for Slate.
Well, I'm gonna give you my takedown on this, because I look through this and it's like they looked at like a list of top Apple podcasts. All right, you know, podcasts there, and they said, let's do our version of that. Let's do our version of that. And granted, these were already things that had thousands of different versions of that, and that was problematic. Where you know, it, what's amazing is how, like, the success of Serial, where, you know, hey, we're going to follow a crime story over, you know, 8 episodes or this. And that's, and of course, then everybody says, we're going to go do that. And it's like, well, yeah, or just a suggestion. Why did it work? It was very different, but engaging content, longer form, engaging content. What else is out there? What else is out there that you could go do, you know? And that's, you know, and I think,
well,
that-
although I will say the podcasts are similar to me, as the writing world, that, like, you know, oftentimes when you're done with the big book that you already, when you finish reading Game of Thrones and now there's no more Game of Thrones, the next thing that you might want to read is another immersive fantasy kind of thing.
True. And if you're a fantasy writer, now you're going to be competing with 1,000 other people that said, I'm going to create this next.
So exactly. Right. So you better hope it's good. I mean, ultimately, like, there's an audience, but, you know, yeah, there was a reason why when you did the Jessica Blackwood novels, it was like you were also steering toward a popular genre.
But what I did though was I went into a market that was popular, right? And yes, and I think that crime thing is it's a genre. I'm saying it's not a bad genre to go into, but you're always going to be following, you know, if you're I went in there because I go, hey, James Patterson's on top. I don't mind being, you know, what distant from there, but that's an existing genre. People buy stuff every month and do this, okay? But also, I didn't say I'm going to do kind of a note-for-note version. I did a different enough differentiated myself in what I was doing.
Sure. Oh,
my
yeah,
stuff did quite well. And I guess that's my point. I said, okay, I'm not going to do the same thing that's out there that's been done there because I don't want it to be like ersatz version of this other thing. I have to pick a category. I have to pick a category. To try to define a new category in books is hard to do that. What they did with Serial was great, was they had this really cool longer form thing that was well produced and engaging. And I'm saying, like, if you're BuzzFeed, you know, yeah, it would have been great if they did, you know, long form crime reporting or something. I don't know, something, because BuzzFeed has done some great reporting.
Oh, no, right? They've done really good stuff.
You know, and you look at their podcast and it's just as me too. And I got, that's my point, is that it's like, if you're going into a super crowded marketplace and you expect yourself to differentiate yourself without any real reason to do that, it's problematic. I would say if you're BuzzFeed and you can pay for really good content, they should have taken, you know, partner up a really good podcaster with one of their best writers and say, let's do this deep dive. Let's do a really cool, like what you're doing, you know, with your, you know, your political season stuff. I think that.
Well, I bet for BuzzFeed, which is very, very heavily in the written and video elements, it's easier for them to say, okay, well, let's do a video. Let's not do a podcast version of that thing when we already have these other verticals that are our bread and butter, right?
But I think they would just complement each other, you know? I think that it's a, you know, my opinion on that is that, like, you've got a strength. You've actually, BuzzFeed is one of these, because I always think of them as sort of this airhead, memeable, whatever, silly sort of stuff, which they are. But yeah, then every now and then I get delighted when I read about some really good reporting that came from BuzzFeed. And I think that's, instead of doing everything on that podcast page for the most part is just super disposable. It's done in a million other places. There's nothing in it that appeals. It feels like, oh, this is a different, you know, some different voices that we may not have heard as much. You know, there's, we've got a Muslim American doing a podcast there, whatever, but it's like nothing that's really, I don't know. And like, I know they did, like, what's the TV show or something? They did that. Like,
I believe they've got a Netflix. No, that's Fox.
Yeah, and I can't even get past the promos because it's just like it's your stereotypical kind of, you know, East Coast sort of writer. Like, I decided to go look into this. It's like, oh God, just write the article and maybe I'll read it.
But that's the thing, right? Is like should they stick with the mediums that are working, or should they try?
But I think, like, here's, I guess, and I think we're dancing around the idea that, like, hey, look, everything is separate. Every medium has its own story to tell. And either you are going to take it seriously or you are going to just say, all right, bare minimum, we can launch based on the page impressions. We can launch a new podcast and we can auto flow it as an ad into X amount of impressions. And reliably, we know we'll be able to generate on BuzzFeed readership, you know, Y amount, a advertiser friendly guaranteeable amount of downloads for that. Right. And we'll do it all in house and we'll have a bunch of writers in their off time that really want to get into podcasting, do it. And they won't pay them much more and we'll do it on the cheap. That'll be it. Right. Instead of saying, no, look, if you want to get into podcasting, you should really think about getting into like the business of podcasting. It should be a sustainable kind of thing if you want to do that. And it seems like for BuzzFeed, it wasn't, which I can understand them trying to just push that dinghy out in the water on the cheap and then watching it capsize and being like, well, turns out we can't sail.
Yeah. So there we go. Problem solved.
Nailed it.
My advice is this. My advice is this, is if you're going to pick something like, you know, Serial worked, like, for the same reason, like, you know, I've been lucky with books. People like crime. People like these sorts of things. And I don't say avoid crime at all as like a podcast topic, but Serial was successful and was a leader because they went into when everybody else is doing, you know, like we're on a couch. We're going to talk like the super light disposable content. They did deep form, you know, deep dive into something really well researched, you know, really well put together and presented. And it was extremely engaging. And all of a sudden it became, you know, now everybody wants to do that. And my point is, like, I have to believe there are other ideas and other kinds of things out there. And that's, yeah, you know, go dig into that, you know.
Nice.
Any picks?
Yeah, I want to just give a shout out. I don't even know if she listens to this show, but on Saturday.
Your wife.
Yeah. Well, I know she doesn't listen. I got an amazing gift. B Rainbow Bright in the chat sent along a handcrafted.
Oh, it's amazing.
Oh, that's cute.
Cheery, like, doll.
It's a doll.
This is like my buddy sized. So I just want to, on every show that I'm on this week, I want to show it off and give her credit because it is amazing. There were a couple other Frog Pants hosts that she made them for, but there we go. The My Jury doll, which comes with.
Whoa.
A little own microphone.
Its own microphone that when you press in the center. There we go. One of the intros from Unfriend Me. There we go. My pick is Be Rainbow Bright being an amazing human being and making me this amazing doll.
Aww. That is amazing.
That's great.
I got in time for the picks.
Yep.
You did.
Counterpart, it's back. You should watch it. In fact, I'm going to say you might be able to just start at the beginning of season two. That'd be an interesting experience. Hop on open up the free trial of Stars on Amazon for a week and watch 1 week of episodes.
Is the first, I guess it just premiered. Is the premiere any good?
Yeah, it's a different framework. You know, it takes for granted that you know things about the worlds and who is where. But even if you don't, it's a different thing because they've shut down the border between the two places. I'm going to speak kind of in code. And so now it's a game of rooting out who doesn't belong in one place or another.
I see. Yeah, I think I'm out of picks. Andrew?
My pick is, I just started listening to it. You got to get past the, and I feel like I just mentioned this to a friend, so I feel like I picked this last week, but I'm pretty sure I didn't. You got to get past the first, you know, 40 minutes of like, why, you know, what's this book about? What's this book about? You sold me. I bought it. Let's, what we're going to show you, what we're going to talk about. And that is Blitzscaling by Reid Hoffman. Reid Hoffman doesn't get as much attention as, let's say, Elon Musk, or, you know, hasn't been cast as the villain like Peter Thiel, but Reid Hoffman was one of the other founders of PayPal. Reid Hoffman, after the success of PayPal, went off to create LinkedIn and other enterprises. And so blitzscaling is his approach towards, hey, this is, if you want to build a high value business, this is the way you do it. And it is counterintuitive. He talks about like data that says like you don't want to go. Oh, he co-wrote it with Chris Yeh, by the way. I should point that out. And Bill Gates wrote the foreword. So when Bill Gates says, you know, hey, this is worth listening to, it's probably, you know, something to take account for. He talks about the idea that sacrifice efficiency for fast growth. He says when you're trying to create a company, your goal is to grow really, really fast. He says even if it's inefficient, even if you risk, you know, upsetting customers, even if your products are going to break, you know, which none of those should be the ideal. You're better to grow fast and challenge yourself more than, he says, companies that like have steady yearly. He says the most successful companies have higher than 40% growth rates by the time they reach $100 million, meaning the time they reach $100 million valuation, they're increasing their value at 40% or more greater a year. 20% year growth, Wall Street likes, says, oh, this is really good. He says, yeah, but if you want to be a Facebook, if you want to be a big, if you want to be a $1 billion company, a successful company, your rate of growth has to be much faster. And he gives examples of how like Airbnb had some nice steady growth, and then they were threatened by these German brothers who build knockoffs of other companies. Like they would build their European version of Groupon and force Groupon to buy them, phrases, you know, competing with them. They created a knockoff version of Airbnb in Europe, and they went to Airbnb and are like, hey, we'll trade you because we have, they had 800 employees and like dozens of offices and stuff. And they said, hey, acquire us for 25% of the value of Airbnb. And now Airbnb is faced with this problem because they didn't really have a European expansion yet. And like, what do? We just say yes and give them 25% of our company and we get this? And, you know, they went to their advisors and people, they talked about it, and like Zuckerberg's, you know, like screw them, you know, like, and other people are like, yeah, like, you know, somebody else pointed out like these guys have a baby they don't want. They're trying to trade it to you because it's a threat. And then Airbnb said, you know what? Screw this. We're going to raise like another $100 million. We're going to rapidly expand into Europe ahead of time when we wanted to do that. And they did that. And they, you know, blitzscaled in Europe and then basically became the, you know, the dominant, you know, Airbnb type service there too. So blitzscaling. Right now I'm probably 20%, 25% into it. I'm really enjoying it. I like it because it's not, it says things that are counterintuitive, and there are people that would strongly disagree with it and say, no, it's wrong. It's not the way to build a business. But Reid Hoffman's got a pretty good track record, and to have, you know, the number of people like, no, this is the real deal, it's pretty impressive.
Right on.
Somebody says everybody knows about those German brothers that create knockoffs. Well, the fact that we can't remember their names doesn't mean everybody knows. They're doing it like 20 years. Subscribers, they have not been sued out of existence. You can't be sued for a business plan. You know, like you can try to patent that, but if you know you want to go do a thing, you know, somebody makes something. If you copy the product itself, that's problematic. And Airbnb wasn't the first place to say, hey, want to rent a couch, you know, or want to stay here, like couch surfing, all these things. A lot of these big businesses that exist today, Uber, Airbnb, there were versions of that before, but they figured out the right one and they had the right energy. So I think these guys, I think totally right to do it, you know, opportunity. Everybody good?
Yeah, we're the best.
Yep. Little Justin?
Yeah, he's good.
No, I meant you, but that's okay. It's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.